first book you'll hear him referred to as my friend. Should you hear a lot of it at different times and in different parts of the country, quoting us how Bill came in, how the organization, all the fellowship started, there's only one man in the world tonight who knows exactly how it started, because he was sober and Bill was drunk. So, I give you my friend and your friend, our founder, Ebby.
Thank you, Dick. Well, as Dick told you, my name is Ebby, and I'm an alcoholic. I know I just had a slight bit off. Dick asked me over here. I was very glad to come, if you wanted to meet some of you Memphis people. When I had an idea, I was one of two or three speakers, and I didn't know I was going to hold this thing down for 40 or 45 minutes. And back home in Dallas, I'm known as the world's greatest speaker. They used me back there on the different clubs for the 10-minute and 15-minute spots. So I don't know how I'm going to go about holding down for 45 minutes, but I'll do the best I can. As I say, I've been living in Texas for 5 years now. Maybe I've gotten enough of that Texas braggadocio somewhere in my system. Maybe I will serve some so I can pull some of that out of the hat. There's a story I heard a year or two after I got in Dallas that, well, it's taken a while, fancy. I hope you'll indulge me and let me tell it. The Texas rancher drove over to his nearest neighbor, was about 15 miles, and said, what do you say we go to town and make a day of it? So I said, all right. Got his hat, and then he got in the car, and he started out. As soon as he got out of sight of the ranch house, they opened up the first boarding, had a good long pull on the bottle, and the host guy said, you know, so they shipped 3,000 bulls from Fort Worth the day before yesterday. After this said, they drove on a line and came to the gate, and they had opened that, and they had another pull at the bottle, and the second guy said, you know, I shipped 2,500 bulls from my siding 4 or 5 days ago. So they drove along, and just before they got to the main state highway, they stopped for a third good hooker, and the first rancher said again, you know, I think we're the two biggest bull shippers in Texas. And I hope I have a crowd who will that so I can get it out tonight. I know that Dick and Jim Drake and some of the other boys wanted me to tell you some of the beginnings of AA as I experienced them. And you know, I think that I appreciate the things that Dick has said and other people have said about me. But I sometimes think that my chief claim to fame is that I'm Exhibit A in the Antique Division of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's about it. Well, I got to go back to some of my beginnings. I started drinking when I was in school. I come from Albany, New York, as my native town. Went to a private school there, and I started drinking that last year. I seemed to hold it under control pretty well. But I did get off on a wild party one night. It was a military school, and we had a competitive drill. And after the drill, we all went out, and that is, some of us were out and got drunk. And we got in a mess, and the principal of the school heard about it. But nothing was said. But I wasn't very well that spring, and they took me out of school before school was over, and that summer the principal wrote to my father, and he always called me Ed. He didn't call me Ebby or Ed. He said, I don't think we can do anything more for Ed. Which meant that he was just selling us from school. So that fall, my father said, you're going to work in the foundry. My father happened to be in the iron foundry business. So I went to work that fall. And I confined my drinking to Saturday nights. Naturally, I had to get up 6 o'clock to down. I worked as a molder's helper, which is fairly rugged work, as you may know. And I did that for a year, and I can find most of my drinking due. Saturday nights, except around Christmas time and all the dances were going on. And when I really stepped out, I remember I tried to go to work, drinking and dancing and getting down to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, but I was young, and just take it off and work it off by night. And I managed to get away with it for a while. But as I look back and remember those times, I wasn't a very successful drinker from the start. There were times, too, when I'd take some of the older guys around all me home, and other times I'd be climbing a chandelier after 3 or 4 drinks. I never knew what was going to happen. Fact of the matter is, when I was about 15 years old, I remember putting a lot of thought into this business of drinking because it was in my family. My brothers drank pretty heavily, and my father did. And I kind of figured if they drank that way, and it wasn't any good for them, and it was no good for me either, because I was just about the same temperament as they were. But it was that first drink that I ever took on my own when I walked into the bar of the Hotel Tonight in Albany and ordered a glass of beer all by myself, and I was a big shot. And I still say that was the very best glass of beer I ever tasted. Sometimes I can almost taste it again. And somehow that just gave me just the same glow, and that beer was a lot stronger in those days, and it was real beer. That was about 1914, I think. And I know that I said to myself, this is for me. And soon after that, when I started drinking, I kept it down pretty well, 2 or 3 drinks. I used to go out of an evening that spring. And this friend of mine, I went to school, he called me up and asked me if I had my lessons done. I said, sure, he said, just a stall because the family was sitting in the room. And I said, sure, Andy, I'll go out and have a chocolate milk with you. I've got time. And we were far from chocolate milk. But I managed to get home by 11 o'clock, so there was nobody knowing anything about it. But I know the effect and the taste of alcohol was fascinating to me from the beginning. And later on, I read a book called The Common Sense of Drinking, from which a lot of AA was taken, by Dick Peabody. He's not dead, but he was one of the first of the lay therapists that had a tremendous following of alcoholics. A lot of other books have been written by a lot of his pupils. The Glass Crutch is one of them, by Dutch Chambers, and I can name a half a dozen. I can't think of one now. But he said in that book that the difference between an alcoholic and a heavy drinker was that the heavy drinker might drink just as much on a given night as the alcoholic, but the next day is another day to him, and he went to work, and his first thing in the awakening in the morning was the office. Well, the first step that the alcoholic had was the night before, and where could he get the next drink to bring that party back again? And that always appealed to me because that's the way I was. I'd forget business and want to get somewhere where I could get with the gang again. And he said, the effect of alcohol on people of your type is too fascinating. You can't handle it. But I knew then, and coupled with the drinking in my family, I figured out that I better stay away from it, but I never did once I had that drink. Well, as time went on, I, of course, got into a lot of more trouble. And the family business broke up. It was one of those things to do that had been running since 1852, and it broke up in 1922. And I was more or less on the loose and going from one job to another and getting in more trouble all the time. My drinking was increasing. I didn't get overseas in World War I, but I was in the outfit that was stationed around right in my hometown of Albany. And in the State Army there, I got to be a second lieutenant in this outfit, and we always had a jug in the officer's quarters because it was a druggist in one of the corners right near the Armory. Then always, in summer, I managed to get a barrel of whiskey, and we could get it because those were the days of prescription. Doctor would issue you a prescription during Prohibition, and you'd go in and get this pint of whiskey, but we got it all we wanted. We got that gallon jug filled repeatedly. And there was a 42-fifth of drinking crowd, and they were all older than I was. And finally, we got into a jam one night. We got in a taxi wreck, and I just got superficial cuts on my both wrist and face. But I was kind of a bloody mess. It was just bleeding a lot. My father came in. I was sitting on the bed, and he says, "You get out of that National Guard tomorrow morning," he said, "or you leave my house." Well, I didn't feel like leaving this house right then, so late that afternoon, I walked up and told the captain I was going to resign, request to be put on the reserve. So that ended my National Guard career and that phase of the drinking. But things got worse, and my father and mother died in 27, my father in 29. I was sticking around then pretty bad. I inherited some money from my father. I should have had sense enough to take care of it. But I didn't. I lost half of it overnight in a stock market crash, and the rest I just down the drain. Over a period of a year and a half. And we used to summer in Vermont, and it was there that I met Bill Wilson, but it was longer ago than 24 years ago. I first knew Bill about 1910. I went to school with him in 1912, which has taken us back quite a few years. And, to get back, we went to summer in Manchester, Vermont. Well, after my father died, the house was vacant up there. We bought a house after all the years that father had spent money at the hotel for all of us. He bought a house in 1923, and in 1929 he died, and the house was empty. All my other brothers were married. Father died without a will, so they just divided up the furnishing, left some for me, and I had one room furnished in that house, and the rest was bare. And I was living there, all alone. Drinking heavily all the time. Got a regiment. We jump now. We're going to get up to the summer of 1934, which is 24 years ago. And I'd been in the toils of the law twice that summer. I'd gotten drunk, or gotten arrested for being drunk and disorderly. Fined $5 or something like that. And it seems that in Vermont at that time, I don't know whether the law is still on the statute books or not, but if you got arrested three times, anyone giving you for drunkenness, it meant 6 months in Windsor State Prison. Well, I was getting drunk right along. One time I got drunk, and I still don't know exactly how it happened, but I was in my own house, and apparently somebody got out a wire for me. I failed to see yet what I was doing. As I was on my own property. But one of the boy that was constable at the time was a guy that I'd gone to school with in 1912, the same year that I went to school with Bill Wilson. I forgot to say that I went to a private school in Albany, but this one year I went up there in Vermont in 1912, in the fall of 1912, to go to that school for one year and then back to my other. And this other boy is John Jackson, was constable. And I walked uptown the next day. I went up to sit on the steps of the hardware store to talk to the owner of it. My son John drove up and said, "Sorry," he says, "Evie, but I got a warrant for you. I got to take you down to Bennington," which is a county seat. He took me down and saw the judge. And the judge says, "Be back Monday. We'll see what we can do about you." Well, I've gotten ahead of my story, because before that, I'd say late in July or the first part of August. Two men came to see me, two fellows that I had drunk with often. One of them happened to be the son of this judge. His name is Steve Graves, and he's now living in Paris, France. And the other one was Chip Cornell, and I don't know just where he is. I think he's somewhere in Ohio. I had a hangover, of course, and these two guys wandered around. I was out and back somewhere, in the kitchen, I guess. But I remember they came up the back steps. And they didn't know exactly how to begin on me, because they remembered me and having a lot of fun with me drinking. And I saw they had something on their mind, so I said, well, what you got on your mind? What's cooking? And they said, well, we kind of come to see you and see if we can get some idea in your head about something. I said, you mean about my drinking? They said, yeah, you're not getting anywhere. I understand you're in wrong all over town. And we got mixed up with a group called the Oxford Group. And we think that you could get help if you'd grown up with it. And they said, do you ever think of letting God run your life instead of every pastor trying to run it all the time? And they really talked sense the way I figured it, and it seemed to me that they were just telling me things that I had been taught in my childhood about the right way of living. And I said, well, gee, if these two guys have got something out of this, maybe there's hope for me, because I've just about given up hope. And I tell you, I was willing to quit drinking, but I didn't know how. Excuse me. I didn't know how to do it. So I listened to them, and they left me a book by one of these men in the Oxford Group. I don't recall the name of that book now. But in it, I could see myself staring out of those pages. Now, the Oxford Group, let me explain, was not concentrated on alcoholism. It was a spiritual group. It was founded by a minister from Pennsylvania named Frank Buchman, B-U-C-H-M-A-N. It got its name, Oxford Group, because Buchman got a lot of people interested, and they in turn went abroad, and they went to England and Oxford University, and they got a lot of people interested over there. And from there, they went to South Africa. And they got up quite a big meeting down there. I don't know if it was Cape Town or one of those cities. And the reporters referred to them as the group from Oxford, and their damn name stuck, and it had no more to do with the group or its findings and anything in the world. But just like those things happen, that's the name that stuck with it. And it was called the Oxford Group. And they were really trying to find something. It was that time in 1929 when the crash had come on Wall Street, and the nation was kind of a low point economically. A lot of people were hopping out of windows in New York, and that's no joke, because they were. A lot of them hit those manholes head-on from the 30th floor. And a lot of people were drinking terribly, and they wanted to find something in this Oxford Group. A lot of people came around to it, and of course a good many of them happened to be alcoholics. And don't ever let yourself think that nobody but an alcoholic can help an alcoholic, because there were a lot of men and this group that were very understanding and had a damn good knowledge of the thinkings of an alcoholic's mind. And I sometimes think that our minds are no different than anybody else in this world. We just give in to things that other people do not. Well, anyway, that idea appealed to me. I read the book, and I filled it up for a few days, and I had started to paint the house. But I had a ladder that was too short, and I couldn't get up to all these places. And I made a deal with a boss painter, and he sent around one of his men with some equipment, and the two of us finished the house. I didn't touch a drop all that time, but the minute that job was over, sure, I went right back to Butler because they had nothing more to interest me. It was a wet time. And it was then, on that means after the thing in the house that I was picked up, and taken to this county judge. There's one thing that sticks in my mind, and it always will. Well, I knew it would at that time. It may not mean anything to you, it may not get what I mean by it, but as we drove home that afternoon, Mr. Constable John Jackson left me off at the house that I was living in, and he said, well, I'll be around to get you Monday. This was Friday. And he said, you remember the judge said to be sober? I said, yep, I'll be sober. So I went in the house, and I remembered that down cellar I had about a half a dozen bottles of ale, and I know that they're going to be nice and cool. And there's one thing I like in this world, it's Ballantine's ale, and that was it. So I went down cellar, and I said to myself, I can't possibly get drunk between now and Monday on 6 bottles of ale, and I know that nobody in town is going to sell me anymore after they've heard that I... You know what a small Vermont community it is. Everybody from 10 miles up and down the valley knows all about anything like that. And I knew that any of the bootleggers wouldn't sell me anything. And I got down, and I reached one of those bottles, and that ain't cricket. All right, the judge said, you get there sober, will you? You be there sober. No, that isn't, that's cheating, that's somehow. And I walked back upstairs, and that damn devil dropped on my shoulder. Get on, go on down there and take it. I couldn't take that damn ale. I said, that's not the spirit of the thing. It might be, technically, I might be all right. I'd get there sober, I expected it. Well, that's exactly what he meant. He didn't say don't take a drink, but that's exactly what he meant. So I took them and put them in a basket and carried them over to my next-door neighbor, and I said, here, they're yours. And that minute, I had a victory. I know that. I had something that was just like a weight being lifted from my shoulders. And I've often thought about it. In later years, when I started drinking again, why I couldn't recapture that feeling that I had then. But perhaps that's it. It's the pink cloud. And later on, you get a more mature, if I may use the word, outlook. But I don't think if you have a slip, you can ever go back again. Well, as it turned out, I went down there Monday, and there had been a third man come to see me, too. Name was Roland Hazard. And he was a pretty slow gent, too. I never knew him. I never met him before. These other two guys I had. And he was there Monday when I was brought before the judge. The judge tried to give me a little lecture, and he says, Hazard, will you take this man? And he says, sure. So I was released in my own recognizance, and the charges were dropped. And this guy took me, and he took me back home and left me there. And a few days later, I closed the house up, went down and stayed with him. He lived about 15 miles below, south of the town. And then we went on down to New York. And I stayed with Chet Cornell, and one of his other chaps had come to see me. I stayed there about a month, I guess. And during that time, we made trips back to Vermont, Hazard and I, and 2 weeks after I was connected with this Oxford group, by which there's a much looser membership than Alcoholics Anonymous, I really think, I went and got me out speaking. The first weekend that I went out speaking, we went up through Vermont. I spoke in a junior college, 2 churches, town meeting hall, and someplace else, all in 2 nights. 2 afternoons and 2 nights. And I still don't know what I talked about. But I just felt good about the whole thing and really figured that these guys must have something, that there must be a higher power, because they were the ones that originated the phrase, believe in a higher God or a higher power, or did you understand him? And it was while I was doing this and going back to New York, and I heard about Bill. I haven't seen Bill, I don't believe, for over a year. Although Bill, you see, was born and raised in the town 6 miles north of this town of Manchester, Vermont, where I used to summer. I also spent quite a few winters there. And I heard that Bill was in pretty tough shape, drinking bad, and I had been downtown in Wall Street and seen some of my old friends, one of whom married Bill's sister-in-law, and he said he was in tough shape, and he said, why don't you give him a ring or telephone? And I said, well, I will, but I want to think this thing out a little and get myself a pretty good story, a pretty good take to get for him. And I can truthfully say now that I believe that if I went over there, Bill would either go for it, lock, stock, and barrel, or he would have none of it. He wouldn't just play around with it for a little while. I thought that if he put his teeth into it once, he'd stick to it. Because I thought I knew him pretty well, having gone to school with him and seen him over the years. So I called him up one night. I didn't get Bill, but I got Lois, his wife, and told her what had happened to me, that this wants to kind of show me something. Well, I don't even sober myself in about possibly 6 or 7 weeks. But I think sometimes the initial effect that we get from a thing is we're more powerful then than we are later on. We get stale. Well, anyway, Lois said, why smoke at dinner that night? And then she mentioned the date. I said, fine. So that night, I went over about 5:30, I guess, in the evening. And I rang the bell at 182 Clinton Street. The only person home was an old colored man named Green, who I've known for years. He'd been with the family. And Lois's family, that is. And he said, they're both out. Both Mrs. Wilson, Mr. Wilson, and I would come on in. So pretty soon Bill appeared, and he'd been drinking, but he wasn't too bad. And he said hello, and this, that, and the other thing, and he's kind of edging around. Then he made an excuse. He had to go out and get some ice cream, and something else for supper, and, of course, I know what he's going after. I understand. I've done it so many times myself. So, then Lois came in. And there was another girl invited. There was a girl invited because she lived upstairs and had made the place in her apartment. So we all sat down to dinner. And Bill's got a little garbled in the book about the gin across the kitchen table, but no major difference. The idea is there. Now, we had dinner, and then we all moved upstairs in those houses, and we were back there in the east. Most of the living rooms on the second floor. So we moved up on the second floor, and after a little hammering and hawing, Laura said, well, let's hear about yourself. So I started in. I guess they got me wound up, and I guess that talk was put in 1 o'clock in the morning. And I remember Bill said, I walked the subway with her. And I knew that he wasn't going to go for a drink, or but he had a bottle in the house anyway. And on the way over, he put his arms around my shoulder just before I went on the subway. He said, I don't know what you got, kid, but you got something, and I want to get it. Well, he didn't stop drinking right away any more than I had stopped drinking back there that summer when the Oxford group boys came to see me. But the idea was in there, and the idea happened to get in Bill's head. And at that time, I had moved to a mission on 1st Avenue and 23rd Street in New York City. It was run by Calvary Episcopal Church and called Calvary Mission. It was run under the auspices of this Oxford group. It was just a typical so-called Bowery Mission. We had 12 men who were running it, and excuse me. We only had available beds for about 35 men, and they were full every night. So I was with a man, and about 2 nights after I'd been over to see Bill, he appeared at the mission. Just as the meeting was about to start, well, this, he had a guy in tow, and they were both visibly drunk. But not too bad, and long about... There's a great many of those meetings there were what's called testimonial meetings. We had a man up on the platform, and he would call on various men in the audience. They'd get up, say what they'd found. Of course, most of them were doing it just to get a place to sleep. They called taking a nosedive for God to get a flop. That's the way they expressed it. Well, in the midst of all these proceedings, Will gets up and walks up to the platform, and he's about 6 feet three, you know, and he leans his elbow on the piano, and he starts to spout. And the superintendent says, "Get him down. That's your turn. Pull him down out of there." I said, "Let him go, Will. Let's hear what he's got to say." The guy gave you a dirty look, but he let Bill talk. And then 2 or 3 days later, this was sometime late in November, as I've been talking to Jim and Dick and some of the other boys, I wish that either Bill or I or somebody kept a diary back there so that we could remember dates and have some continuity to our stories. Because you go back 24 years and you cannot for the life of you recall things accurately. Well, this was sometime late in November in 1934. And it's a few days later that Bill got himself a taxi cab and 2 or 3 bottles of beer and went up to Towns Hospital in Central Park West. And when I heard he was up there, I guess it was the next day, I went up to see him. Because I made up my mind that having started this with Bill, it was up to me to stick it out. Which I think is a true thing in every AA 12-step case you go on. If you're going to do it, don't spread yourself too thin and take on 25 or 30 people. I'd rather see you concentrate on one or two. Well, I don't know whether I'm my brother's keeper or not. But I do think that if you start and put something in a man's mind and possibly in his heart and soul, you got to stick with him through his tough spots as well as his victories. Because he's the one who started and it's up to you to see as he gets on his feet. So I followed Bill up there, and we had some talks, and he got out, and he went back down around Wall Street and began to make a few little moves in there, and I kept riding herd on him, as they say out in Texas, but I rode herd on him, and he came around, and he began to attend Oxford group meetings, which, I might add, are exactly the same as AA meetings today. They had a leader. That's what they call it. They didn't call it chairman. They called it the leader and 3 or 4 speakers. And Bill spoke many times from Calvary House and Gramercy Park North in New York City. And later on, when we split from the Oxford group and became Alcoholics Anonymous, we went back to that place and had our meetings there up to about 2 years ago with the original Manhattan group. Now, of course, Ohio, Cleveland, and one of the other cities claim that they are the original AA, but, I don't know. I kind of dispute that a little bit. Because there was a clear succession right through from the Oxford group meetings until the time we broke off, and the meetings went to Aaron Bill's house, and then they went to Steinway Hall on 57th Street, and from there to Bert Taylor's shop on 5th Avenue, and we occupied one of the floors of his tailor shop. And, let's see, the members, it's a direct succession, but I don't care whether Cleveland or anybody else claims the first group. It makes little difference. The thing got started. So, Bill and I were together a great deal that first winter, and then I went back to Albany in 1936. And Bill went on to found AA. He's really the one. I just had something to do with giving him the idea. He went on to, with Dr. Bob, found AA. And in 1937, I had a slip. I fell off the wagon after 2 years and 7 months, which is slightly different from that DuPont film. The DuPont film had me falling off a month after I talked to Bill, but I wasn't sore. I was 2 months, 2 years and 6 months later. And I've had to go to the trouble off and on. If I want to go back and count the years, I can count possibly 15 years of complete sobriety out of the 24, maybe 16 years. But they're the longest for 16 months and 8 months and 7 months and so on. And summer of 1953, I was again in New York City drinking. And I walked into the intergroup one day, and Hazel Wright, one of the secretaries there, said, "I think I've got a man that can help you who's got something real and something tangible." And she said, "I'm going to call him right away." And she called this man, he came down to see me. He says, "Where do you drink?" And I said, "On our own Third Avenue." He said, "Come on, let's go." And he said, "I ran into Feeble Graves, a man who originally came to see you over in Paris, France." He said, "How's old Libby doing?" This guy said, "I don't know Libby, but I hear he's not doing at all." So he says, "Steve told me that you didn't have a chance here in New York, and we don't think you have." I said, "I know damn well I haven't had liquor. I can't throw it off." Well, he said, "How about going to Texas?" Well, I said, "I don't know about that." Well, he expounded on the virtues of Texas and the good old American ways of living that were still down in these parts of the country. He gave me $5 and bought me another drink and said, "I'll see you tomorrow night." So he did, and repeated the fun. Of course, I worked him for another $5. That's for sure. And a few more drinks. And that was Thursday night. I said, "I'm not going to see you anymore, but the office still holds good." Saturday morning, I walked over in his apartment building, and he was outside. He was coming in one door, and I was going in the other. I said, "Charlie, here I am. Name is Charlie Milton." And he said, "Here I am." Well, he said, "You're ready to go to Texas?" "I don't know about Texas," I said, "but I'm ready to quit drinking. I haven't had a drink since last night." So he took me up in his apartment and got me some clean clothes and a shower, which I badly needed. That night he called up Ole Lancaster and Dallas and said, "How about taking this guy down there?" "All right," he said, "send the Yankee son of a bitch down." I could hear Ole booming it out. So the next, he got a reservation that night at American Airlines for Sunday evening, and it was the Sunday before Labor Day, September 6th. And the dirty so-and-so never even gave me a drink. After 3 months drunk, I got on board that plane, and I didn't know whether I was on a plane or a ferry boat or where I was. And I got off the plane, it was a non-stop, and I would have been offshore in hell in a non-stop anyway. I got off that plane, and I was the first person out of it. They no sooner had that thing rolled up, and I zoomed, and I was down on the steps. I had enough flying for one night. When I got down there and I looked around, I saw two big guys, and of course I was having hallucinations all over the place. And I said, "They're either a couple of G-men or they're a couple of goons from some gangster squad." And then I heard that woman's voice again. "There's the Yankee bastard. There he is. I've seen him in New York." So they got a hold of me and I put me in a car and took me down to Texas Clinic. And I stayed there, I guess I stayed there all together about 2 or 3 months. But the first 2 or 3 weeks, it was pretty rugged, because I'm going to tell you right now, I had hallucinations all over the place. I didn't believe I was in Texas. I didn't dare go out of the place. One of the girls there that was taking care of the books and sort of running things took me downtown one day, and I couldn't get back in that place fast enough. I was scared of the car, the traffic, I was scared of everything. And it wasn't when I was there 2 weeks later, the guy said, "I'm going out to mail some letters to the airport. Do you want to go out?" And I said, "I sure do. I want to see this airport and see if I'm really in Dallas."
When I got out there, and I got out of the car, and I walked up to this placard that said, Love Field, Dallas, Texas. I put my hand on it, and I said, all right, I'm in Dallas. I believe it. I swear as I stand here, I did not believe I was in Dallas. Because it's been a pretty rugged drunk and a pretty hot summer, and I hadn't been much to eat in those 3 months. I was drinking everything I could lay on my hands on, then to be cut short like that. Furthermore, they gave me a few goofballs down there, and I hate those things anyway. I hate the effect of them. It just makes me... Well, I'm sorry that I've taken up so much time telling you it's all been on myself, but I didn't know how to bring the history of AAN. You've all seen how it's spread, how it's worked. I know that if it hadn't been for AA when I got to Texas, I never would have been able to survive. Just coming out here alone, I'd have been lost. It was tough enough as it was because I was among strange people, slightly different ways than ours. It was an upheaval to get from the Bowery down here in 6 hours and change yourself all around. But if it hadn't been for those good Texas people and the people in the suburban club, if I hadn't been able to go around there and stay there and shake after 2 weeks before I went in the club, a little over 2 weeks, I walked by one day and started up the steps, lost my nerve, went back to the clinic. Almost like a guy going back and hiding under the bed. And I know the trouble times, they said, well, I know, I heard them talking, man, I don't know what we're going to do with this guy. He's gone goofy. And then I heard a colored girl that worked there. She's quite an old girl woman. And she said, don't you worry about that man. You just leave him alone and he's coming out of it. He's sick. And that's just what I was. I was sick. Mentally and physically. And then gradually I worked out of it. Nature took over. And then I was able to get around the club and get into the activities. And maybe I got in them too fast. That was the hottest summer that had been on record in the Texas Weather Bureau. I went down on a ranch, and I was out working the sheep with this man. He put me in as a shoot man, and that's kind of rugged work in a 95-degree day. And I got mixed up in an oil deal, and I sold some insurance stock, and every one of them flopped. The insurance company did, almost. They're still struggling to get back on its feet. And I got in another deal and that flopped. I was sober a year and 1 month after the year was up, I flopped. And that was in October 1954. I had 13 months and I only had a few days drinking then. And it was over a 3 week period, but I got slapped in the county jail for 10 days and met with Mr. Bill Becker's emporium. And I came out, and some friends took me in their house, and I sobered up. And I haven't had a drink since. In other words, I've had about 5 years sobriety in Texas. Out of 5 years and 1 month, I've had 5 years sobriety. Total. And I know that I'm grateful to Fever Graves over there in Paris and Charlie for following it up. And for the people in Texas, and over here, all of you people have given me another chance. I couldn't have done it by myself. It isn't under my own steam I did it. And I know that my sobriety in these last four years that I've been sober, it hasn't been my sole effort that's kept me sober. Nor do I believe it has been entirely the friendship and the help of people. I think it has been the help of a higher power. And while I've lost that idea some times along the next way of life, thank God I got it back again. Because I know that I couldn't exist without it. There are times when I don't have, not like a good many people I hear talk, that they say there isn't a day in their lives that they don't fight the desire to take a drink. Well, I'm telling you right now, flat out, I'd go get drunk. I couldn't be that much of a hero to fight it every day and every hour. I don't have that. But I do have periods every 3 or 4 months when it's maybe 2 or 3 days it's rugged. That's all I think about. He's taking a drink, and if I haven't got myself conditioned to the correct way of thinking and knowing that if I take that drink, where I'm going to end up, and I have no doubt that this time, I know that that last drink that was drunk, that liquor knocked me so badly physically and mentally too that I'd never survive another one. And I get that in my head, and I keep it there in spite of the fact that I want to go out. And I get sick of this being in harness every day and going to work. And I'm getting along in years, and I like to have a little rest once in a while, but I got to go and work. And I often think if I come home tonight, if I could take one good slug of whiskey or one bottle of Ballantine's ale and go eat, it would help me a lot, and it probably would help me physically. It'd give me a lift. But I know I can't do it. So what is the use of time of the idea? I don't quite get so much the idea that I used to. And I'd like to get drunk. Although that occurs once in a while because I think in every one of us is another person, is an alter ego. And that old drunk, that was Evie Thatcher, is still in there. He may be dormant, but he's there. He's just like a volcano. He picks the top off and he's going, zoom! Only this time it goes in, boom, under the hole. And I haven't got anything much more to say except stick to your AA and stick to God. And I think that you'll find that if you're having any trouble, you'll find help there. I want to thank Dick and I want to thank the other members and all you people who have entertained me, and I sure have enjoyed coming to Memphis. Thank you.
Evie from Dallas, Texas.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sold on San Francisco. Say that. I had two charming ladies take me on a tour today. And they certainly did a fine job. I saw everything I wanted to see in a short time. I'd like to the Cliff House and saw the Embarcadero and Fisherman's Wharf from the top of the mark. We covered a lot of ground. And it's nice to be here. I've been asked to go over the early ground of AA. And to do so, I've got to give you some of my background as a young man. I was born and raised in Albany, New York. Some of you know, the capital of the state. And my father and mother rented a summer cottage in Manchester, Vermont, which is only 60 miles away. And it was a short trip up there by train and later on by automobile. Although I remember the first time that we made it, it was a car that we half-built ourselves in our foundry machine shop. It took 3 days. And then they wound up on a hill 4 miles south of the village that broke down for the third or fourth time. We had to be hauled in by a team of horses, and I could see the local constable saying, "Get a horse, get a horse." I can still hear it. I see my father and my older brothers coming in. And it was there that I met Bill Wilson in Manchester, Vermont. I went to school in Albany, but I formed a great friendship with the minister's son, and he went to the local school up there. It's a high school. And he persuaded me, and I in turn sold a bill of goods to my family. I'd stay up there winter and go to the school up there. And I had met Bill casually before, but I got to know him very well that winter, and we became good friends. And that's where our friendship started. And of course, he married Lois Wither Burnham, who had a summer cottage directly across from ours on the main street of the town. And I knew her from childhood. In fact, she's a little older than I am. She can remember me when I was in the baby carriage. And so that takes us up to through the time that I knew Bill Wilson. In my last year in school, which turned out to be my last year because I got drinking and was expelled. Well, I wasn't exactly expelled, but the principal of the school wrote my father a letter that summer that didn't think they could do anything more for me, which is practically the same. And so I just didn't show up that fall, and my father put me to work in his iron foundry. And my drinking was then somewhat regulated. I would hold it down on Saturday nights, although I'd get drunk. I was never could tell what I was going to do. I might drink some of the older men under the table, and I might get drunker than a hoot out of three or four drinks and raise the devil and have a hard time. But I generally managed to keep it on Saturday night. I knew as a young man, I think, that when Bill and I went to school, we talked the situation over because the condition was in both our families. My father drank too much, my brothers did, and I could only figure that I was just the same as they were. And in makeup, temperamental makeup, and I felt it go the same way. But one time in Albany, I walked into the barroom of the hotel tonight, and I ordered a glass of beer. And it's the finest glass of beer I ever tasted. And I said, this is for me. Just that one beer, just a little warm feeling of dirty. But I used it because I had no confidence as a young man. In the gathering of people, I was all right with one or two of my cronies, but when I got on the gathering, I was lost. And I found that alcohol would overcome that, and I'd become more or less the life of the party. And I guess that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be kingpin in everything I did, probably. And yet I wasn't quite good enough. That alcohol brought me up to the point where at least I thought I was. But it began to get pretty bad as the years went on, and Saturday nights drunk progressed into one or two nights during the week. And when the Christmas holidays came around and the Debs came out and the dances and all that, like, I didn't get much work done in the foundry. I got to drinking pretty heavy. And it went from bad to worse, and I was in lots of hot water and lots of trouble. And so I'd go on and drunk and couldn't get off it. I remember taking the first drink in the morning, and I started the ball rolling right back in the bottle again. Well, to skip a lot of the blow-by-blow description and get up to 1934, I was living alone in the house in Manchester. My father and mother were both dead. And strange as it may seem, we'd never bought a house up there until 1923. My mother died in 27, and father in 29, and I was living there alone, and I was drinking to beat the devil. My brothers were all married, and they'd taken most of the furniture, and they left some stuff for me, and I lived there. And I was trying to paint the house alone. And I had a ladder. I didn't have sufficient equipment, but I was too shaky to get up on that ladder. And I was making a mess of things, generally. I'd been arrested a couple of times for drunkenness out around the town. And three times in Vermont is a mandatory 6 month sentence in the state prison. So these fellows came along, a couple of them that I'd been drinking with, used to drink with, known them for years, and they collared me down at the house one day, and they started talking to me about this Oxford group they'd become interested in. And I listened because they made sense. I know that I don't think that they were alcoholics in the sense that I am. They both drank heavily. But I think that they were more or less power hungry, though, both of them. One was a New York stockbroker, and he just wanted to have the world by the horns where he could run it. But that talks a lot of sense to me. They left a book with me, and they said, now, you've been trying to run your life your own way. You're down on your luck, and you're not getting anywhere, and you're drinking yourself to death. Why don't you try turning your life over to God? Well, that made sense to me, and I sobered up for a few days, and I wrote my brother in law that I'd like to get some help on the house, and he wrote back, and said, go ahead, get a local painter, and see what kind of a deal you can make with him. Well, this man had sent over a lot of equipment and one of his painters, and the two of us got the thing done. We took over 2 weeks to do it. This was a big house, a lot of work to still be done around cutting sash and the windows and everything. Well, as soon as that house was painted, I lost all interest again. There was nothing to look forward to, no goal to strive for. At least that house painting was something to be done, to get accomplished. So I went right back in the bottle again. And I was apprehended by the local law for a time. And I appeared before the judge down in Bennington, the local constable whom I went to school with that 1 year. He took me down there, and I appeared before him. And it so happened that he was the father of one of the boys that had come to see me, Seaper Graves, and this was Judge Graves, his father. And he was just Friday, so he'll be back here Monday, and he said, I want you back here sober. And I'm just mentioning this, it's a very little incident. But in my life, it was a big one. It really meant something. When the boy drove the lad that I went down, it drove me back to the house, and I went in there all alone. I remembered that I had three nice cold bottles of ale down cellar. And I said, well, if I drink that ale and space it along, it'll just sort of keep me up a little bit, and I won't hit the depths. And I can't possibly get drunk because I can't tell anyone in town. Everybody knows about this, and I've shut off my supply. And I walked down cellar, and I picked up one of those bottles, and I said, no, wait a minute. Just as I come back there sober, but this isn't exactly cricket. Don't take a drink, is what he meant, really. And you could get back there sober, he'd never know anything about it, but it isn't exactly honest. So I walked upstairs again, and I got up there, and I saw the devil, and this little devil sat in my shoulder, go on, guy, and take that ale. And I walked up and down the stairs three or four times. And finally, I picked them up and put them in a carton and took them over to the man next door, and I said, here's a present for you. And believe me, that was the weight was lifted off my shoulder. It really was. I felt a release from that time on. And I know that night, I sat down beside my bed and said my prayers like I hadn't said them in years. And I said to God, I said, I really mean business. I want to quit this drinking. Well, I stayed around the house for a couple of weeks. It was in October, and it didn't get cold nor inadequate. I didn't want to start the furnace. It was a hot water thing. And one of these men that had come to see me, I didn't know. There was a third man that had come along into the picture. And he also had become interested in the auction group. And he said, well, why don't you shut up the house and come down and stay with me for a few days? He lived in a town below, about 15 miles below, south of Manchester. And he had a home there. And he said, why don't you come and live with me? And we got a lot of speaking to do. And less than 2 weeks after I joined this thing, got interested in it. I was out talking my head off at various places in Vermont. One weekend, I spoke five times, two churches, a junior college, and two town meetings. I don't know what I spoke about or anything, but I guess the people could sense the fact that I had found something. So that went on for a while, and we had people up from New York, sort of what they called house parties, the Oxford group called them. And then I went down to New York, and I stayed with one of these lads who'd come to see me for a week or 2 weeks. And then he made an arrangement with Calvary Episcopal Church, who ran a mission on 23rd Street and First Avenue in New York City in what they call the Gas House District. It used to be called that. And for me to go down, they had a brotherhood of 12 men who ran the place, supposedly under Oxford Group lines and principles. So I went down there and lived for a year. I sometimes think that I shouldn't have done that, maybe a year there, but they wanted me to do it. The only reason is I think I got lazy. I didn't want to get out and work too hard. I mean, that isn't making money, and I had just enough to get by. I had a place to sleep that didn't cost me anything. But on the other hand, maybe it was meant. And in passing, I don't know whether many of you know much about the Oxford Group. I'm not too familiar with it. The Reverend Mr. Glass told me that he'd been a member of it. I'm not too sure of its origins, except it was started by a man named Frank Bookman, who was a member of the cloth. Somewhere in the early 30s, it was 1934 when I came into the picture. And I think that the great interest in it at that time, perhaps, was due to the Wall Street crash of 1929. People who had lost everything, their shirt and everything else in that crash, realized that they had been paying devotion to false gods. That they were not on the right track, and they were completely lost, and they were searching for something, and they heard of this and came there. And of course, among that number were a good many alcoholics, like myself. And I was there, and I really went into the thing with spirit. I tried my best to learn everything they had to teach, and they were pretty thorough in their indoctrination. They had some very fine men, but very wise men, too. And I tried my level best to get something out of that. And I think the reason that they failed, although I understand that they're still in existence out here on the West Coast under the name of Moral Rearmament, they changed the name. And that name in itself was a misnomer, because the thing started here in this country and people went over to Oxford University in England, and in turn from there they sent what they called a team to South Africa, and some reporters there got a hold of it and referred to them as the group from Oxford. And that name stuck and was called the Oxford Group, and it was no more the Oxford Group than Man in the Moon. But I tried, and it was during this time that I was living, and I'd gotten in the mission, and I heard about Bill Wilson, and I heard that he'd been drinking heavily, and was not wanted in very many offices in Wall Street where he worked. He'd been made such a mess of himself. So I determined that maybe I could help him, and I really put some thought into it because I knew that Bill would either take it lock, stock, and barrel and go for it, and he'd really put his weight behind him and get in and push, or he'd reject it. And I think the reason he accepted it was because he saw me sober after so many years of drunkenness, and he was in great need at the time. It just so happened that I was the man who came along at the right time when Bill needed it, with what happened to be the right medicine. So Bill came and went to the Oxford Group meetings with me. And we did a lot of work together. Bill, when I first saw him that night, didn't sober up right away. 3 or 4 days later, he came to one of our meetings at the mission. We had meetings there every night. We had new men, and we gave the ones beds if we could, and we had available beds. And Bill came, the old sailor, and he was drunk, and he even insisted on getting up in the rostrum and making a speech. And the superintendent said, "Get him down, let's let him go, see what he's got." Well, he was all twisted up as a drunk is, but he had gotten something out of my talk. As he walked to the subway with me that night, and he said, "I don't know what you got." And he said, "Whatever it is, I want it." So, next thing I heard was he'd gone to Towns Hospital. He got himself 3 or 4 bottles of beer in the taxi, and he drank the beer on the way up in the taxi. And I went up to see him, and I visited him there 2 or 3 times. And when he got out, I sort of rode herd on him and got him to come around to meetings, and pretty soon he really took a hold of the thing. And he in turn went out, and as you know, the following summer met Dr. Bob in Akron and formed that great friendship and that great fellowship that was so necessary for the founding of AA, along with sisters out there. I can't think of her name for a minute. Which is so necessary to the founding of AA. Of course, Akron claims that they were the first AA group. I don't quite see how, because from the Akron group meetings, Bill Wilson continued the meetings on at his house in Brooklyn. And then we went to Steinway Hall, and New York had a group that was in perfect succession all the time. But when it became Alcoholics Anonymous, and when it, from a springing off from the Oxford Group, I can't tell you, and I don't think Bill can or anybody. Nobody kept a diary, and nobody knew what it was all about, and you go back 27 years, it's pretty hard to remember all the details or to get things straight. The book came out about 1939. And of course, that was a great incentive, and so was the Saturday Evening Post, Jack Alexander. Well, the summer of 1936, I've been in New York nearly 2 years, I decided to go back to Albany. And I lived in the mission, and I'd moved from the mission to Ann Ellison's house, and I wasn't doing much more in the line of endeavor for pay than I had in the other place. And I decided I'd better go back to Albany, my hometown, where I'd made such a mess of things, and where I had so many amends to make. And I did. I went back in the summer, in July or August. And I finally got a job at the Ford Motor Company up in Green Island, which is 8 or 9 miles north of Albany. I worked 2 weeks on the day shift and 2 weeks on the night. I used to come down when I was working on the night shift. I got through Thursday morning. Wasn't due back in again until Sunday. I'd come down to New York every third or fourth weekend. And I don't know, I was getting away from the tracks. I was getting away from what I had found, and I guess there was some one thing that I wanted that God hadn't given me, and I figured that something was wrong, and this little boy had been mistreated. So I got off. I know that one of the men that worked with me in Ford said the last week before you went to New York on that last trip, he said, "You were just like a piece of steel wire. Because you were so tense." He said, "I knew something was going to happen." He wasn't an alcoholic himself. Well, I used to see a girl down there. There was no romance in it. She was just a friend. And take her out to dinner. And I took her out to dinner this one night, and she always had a scotch highball, possibly two, and that's all. She wasn't interested anymore. That was enough. Just so slowly. Little pickup. Well, this night I ordered one. She said, what are you going to do now? She said, kick your legs out from under you. You got 3 or 4 months, nearly a year of sobriety, 2 years of sobriety, and you're going to kick it all and throw it away? I said, one week won't hurt me. Oh, no. That night at 12 o'clock, she finally got the taxi, let me off the Lexington Hotel. New York can get rid of me because I was roaring drunk by that time. And I called Bill up right away, and he sent a couple of guys over the next morning, and they got me out of the hotel over at his house. But it didn't do any good. You start a cycle like that, you got to finish it. And Bill went away for that weekend, and there I was in the house, and he told me there's a bottle of scotch in there. If I was suffering so bad, I needed a drink, so I just stayed drunk for a week there. And I finally went back to Albany and back to the Ford Motor Company. I showed up there Monday morning, and superintendent met me at the clock. I said, where you been? I said, I was down in New York, and I was taking sick with ptomaine poisoning. Yeah. That's my story. I'm going to stick to it. Well, he's going back to work. And I had a man back there, a straw boss, who didn't like me for sour apples, and I guess the feeling was mutual. And I went to work on this machine. I was an inspector in the springs division. And I picked up a leaf of a spring to put it on this testing machine. He said, what are you doing back here? He said, we got a crane broken down out there in the yard, and we got to unload steel by hand. Now, he said, get out there. And out I went in the yard and unloaded this other guy. And I swear, at the end of that day, my hands, I couldn't open them. They were just cramps, looking at that flat steel. Bale after bale of it, you know, bundle after bundle of it. And I used to drive back back and forth from Albany with a man. And we shared expenses, and we got in the car and went out to the gate, and he said, I tried to raise some money for you. He says, I know damn well you need a drink. I said, never mind raising the money. I got it. Let's get to the nearest saloon. Well, that's the last I ever saw of the Ford plant. That was it. A few days later, the man appeared from the Ford plant, one of the security men, and he had a check for one day's pay and asked for my badge. So from then on, I was right back in the same old situation again, drinking, getting sober for a few months, getting drunk again, no incentives to live. I knew I was doing wrong. I knew that I knew the answers, but I couldn't apply them. And this went on in a very unsatisfactory situation. I spent a couple of summers in Kent, Connecticut, in the High Watch Farm, which is the first alcoholic farm, health farm, in this country. I helped run that. I was assistant manager. And then when the man who ran that went on to Beech Hill in New Hampshire, in Dublin, New Hampshire, I went on there with him. I was there in 46 and 47. I was in Connecticut. In 49, I was in Beech Hill in New Hampshire, and I helped him run that. And I was sober as long as I had responsibility and something to do. But when that ended, I went right back to the bottle. And I kicked around New York and kicked around New York. I spent some time in a place called the Chester Crest. And that's, they call it the New York home for intemperate men. It's now going out of existence. It's too bad because it's quite a place. And they worked you pretty hard out on the farm, doing work around the place, and they gave you 5 meetings a night. You had to attend 5 meetings a night and twice on Sunday. And believe me, I got my fill of meetings. But it was right the same thing back again. So that brings us up to the summer of 1953. And I was there in New York. I'd come from this place up there. I'd gotten drunk and gotten kicked out of there. And I was wandering around New York, and I used to drop in the inner group, and it was then on 28th Street in Lexington Avenue. And I must admit it, I was looking for a handout. Trying to get enough to get a few drinks, because if I got in a place, I could get a few drinks, I could cash a few more. And Hazel Rice, bless her, came over to me, and she says, I think I got something for you. She said, Charlie Milton has been over in Paris, France, and ran into one of your friends from the Oxford group who came to see you originally. And then, in passing here, I must say that these men deserve as much credit as I do for taking a message to Bill because they brought the message to me. And she said, he ran in and he wants to see us. So she got right on the telephone and called Charlie, and Charlie says, hold him there till 5 o'clock and I'll be down. Well, I waited. 5 o'clock, Charlie came down. I said, where do you drink? And I sat over on 3rd Avenue, right over the 28th Street. And we said, come on, let's go over. And we sat down and walked to the bar and got a couple of drinks. Sat down, I got a drink, he got a Coke. And he said, well, how would you like to go to Texas? Texas? My God, who wants to go to Texas? I said, they got no water down there, the cattle are dying all over the place. I don't want to go to Texas. I'm broke, I haven't any cent to my name, and I have no clothes. Well, he said, I think it'd be a good idea to get you out of New York, and I think I can arrange to have you taken in down there. Maybe some of those guys will take you in on a ranch. Get you full of health again. Well, he bought me another drink, and then he said, here's $5 an hour. Did you think this thing over? He said, I realize it's quite a proposition to take and swallow in one night. So I went home, and I drank up to my limit of saved a dollar. I think in those days that I learned to drink somewhat because of necessity. I had gotten so sick of being out in the cold weather in New York all night long and riding a subway and getting pinched and spending 10 days in Rikers Island, which is not pleasant. Now, it's not pleasant to walk around those streets in the slush all night long. I used to walk from 14th Street up to 76th Street and back and over 42nd Street to 5th Avenue, down 5th Avenue to 14th and over again and back up. And it takes 3 or 4 trips like that to make a night. Until something opens, and if it's 4 o'clock in the morning, or if you haven't got a cent, so you can get a... And I guess I learned how to hang on to that 75 cents, and maybe a quarter over to get a start in the morning. It's 75 cents to get a bed. So he repeated the performance. He came down at 5 o'clock and took me over there. And bought me another couple of drinks and then gave me the $5 again. That was Thursday night. And he said, if you want to pick this thing up, you can oversee me. He said, here's where I live. Here's my telephone number. Well, I had saved enough from the night before and I could go through Friday night. And I went through Friday night, all right, and Saturday morning, I said, this is it. And I walked up there to see him. I went into his apartment house and he was out in the street and I just happened to catch sight of him. He came in. Well, he says, you're getting ready to go to Texas. I said, I don't know about Texas, but I've quit drinking as of now. I said, last night. Well, he said, let's go up in that room and we'll have a cup of coffee and talk it over. So he sold me the Texas idea and he took me out and got me a clean shirt and gave me a hot shower and threw away my underclothes and got some fresh stuff. And he called Dallas and got a hold of Ole Lancaster and Miss Cersei Whaley. And they made arrangements. They said, yes, I can hear Cersei. Or I think it was Ole. His booming voice from the other end. All right, send the Yankee son of a bitch down here. And it came Sunday. We got flight reservations for Sunday night. And they put me on that plane. And I swear that plane never left certain LaGuardia Fields. Went round, round, round. It seems to me I was in a complete fog. And Charlie had a pint of whiskey there. And wouldn't give it to me. And I told her a couple of years later, I'm going back and start the whole thing all over again. I wanted that pint to come down here. Well, they put me up. Cersei Whaley was running the Texas clinic at that time, and they put me up there. But they didn't give me a drink. They did give me some goofballs, and those things just make me nuttier than the 7 fruitcakes. And the next morning, there were a bunch of people in and out of my room. You'd think I was Exhibit A. They wanted to come in and see this damn Yankee curiosity and couldn't sober himself up, but had been able to sober Bill Wilson up. And there I was going through this thing. If anything I don't want is people around me when I'm going to hang over and coming off one. I just want to crawl off in a corner. And there were more people in and out of that room. You think of some Hollywood celebrity being in there. So I just burrowed further into the bedclothes and just hid myself. And it was hot in there, and I turned off the air conditioner, and Cersei come in and say, what do you turn that thing off for? I said, because it's playing music. And it was. Like all the symphonies and bands and everything else marching. I went out of the street one day trying to find the band, and I couldn't find it. And I used to stand and look out of a little portal in the front door, like one of these observation doors, and there was an apartment house with a balcony across the way, and I see a chair over here on the right, get up and float over and get down over here. I thought that I was never coming back. I mean it sincerely, as I say, and I thought my mind would never come back. And there was an old color lady in there. She says, you leave Mr. Irby alone and let him come out of this in his own way. Did he get well? They were just about ready to send me to a state hospital. I was gone. I went out walking one night, and I don't know where I walked, but I walked at 4 o'clock in the morning, and the police picked me up. And they put me in one cell after another. And I don't know, later on it developed that they thought I was the leader of a car theft gang because I was leaning up against the car. I'd gotten so tired I couldn't walk any further. Well, as soon as it was Sheridan, there was another one of my great friends down there, heard of it, he came down and got me out. And then I began to shake that off and get back in condition. And I began to, as they said, I began to be some fun around there, and I began to go to the AA club. I know I walked by it a dozen times. I'd walk by the dining thing and be scared to go up the steps, shaken and ashamed. And finally, I did, and I went around and got in the spirit of the thing, and I began to get some of this Texas spirit, which, as you know, is very great. And I began to think that maybe I could get the world with a tail again. And I sold some stock in an insurance company, which has turned out to be a fizzle. And I got into an oil deal, which also turned out to be a fizzle. With the consequence that after 13 months, I got discouraged, and I said, well, I guess I never was meant to come down here to Texas. I should have died there in New York, because I don't think I would have survived another winter. And I got drunk again. Well, I didn't stay drunk very long because the law got a hold of me and arrested me, but I got bailed out by a guy that was in their trunk himself that I knew in Dallas. And I was bailed out, but I was back in the county that night for 9 days after the half a day in the city jail. And when I got out of the county at the end of 9 days, one day for good behavior, I was promptly picked up and put back in the city jail. So my drinking was stretched out over about 3 weeks, but there was only about 4 or 5 days of active participation with the bottle. But then I had that long period of going right back into that mental depression again and thinking that there was no use. I was scared to go out on the street, scared to meet anybody. Any time I'd see anybody with a new uniform on, I'd turn right around and run. I stirred it up. But I got out of that. I began to pick up, and then I think finally I began to realize that things were not going to, that the oil wells were not going to come out. And I had to accept that I had kicked myself around, whether it was wholly my fault or not, didn't make any difference. The result was there, that I kicked myself around so long, and it was going to be extremely hard to get a job, and that I would have to settle for what I could do. And I went to work for one of the boys there who owned a printing plant, and I worked for him a year. For the magnificent sum of $37 a week, I think. And I didn't have a car in those days, and then I was out of work for a while, and I worked with Ricky Sheridan out on the road, he's a construction man. I was his flagman on 2 or 3 jobs over in Irving around there. And then I worked with Ben Thompson in a brickyard, and that is reclaiming old brick and selling them for antique brick. And then my present boss came along and gave me this job. And I've been there ever since. And I've been thankful that I could again assume responsibility, and I have been helping out another person in Dallas. And that has given me some incentive to stay sober, so that I've been able to get together 6 years. And that alone has helped me. I am trying to forget the big shot stuff, although sometimes when the pressure of money is on and it's hard to go along, I'm not complaining about the pricks of life. But nevertheless, I say to myself, if I had lived and hadn't been sent to Texas, I would have died there in New York. And so I'm grateful to Charlie Milton and Seabra Graves in Paris and Charlie, who put the thing into motion and followed it through, and it cost him money and it cost him time and effort to send me down to Texas. And I'm grateful to the people in Texas who were patient with me until I snapped out of it and came out of the fog. The gang in New York had discussed it with me, but there were a few like Hazel Rice stuck by me and figured that I had it in me they can only get me in the right spot. So I must put aside the things that I think I'd like and things that I want and yet are not good for me probably, and be grateful that I am alive and able to assume responsibilities of a man and hold a job down. And I am also grateful that I'm able to come out and make these talks. I'm grateful to you people for asking me here, those who put up the money to bring me here, And for my two companions today who took me on such a very good trip, I must say that the hospitality of California is right on a par with that of Texas. And I want to thank you all.